Good morning, all you gastronauts and polyglots. I just wanted to be a little silly.
Yeah, and gourmets and gourmands.
Yeah, and hello world.
Enophiles and...
Yeah, but you're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're going to start introducing you to some of the fun we had in Ireland. In the southeast part only, I mean, we were restricted to geographically so that we could do more in-depth than travel, right?
And it totally turned out to be a place that was both exciting, but also very, what's the word I'm looking for? The word that's sort of relaxing.
Yeah, it was relaxing, but it was also
relaxing
exciting.
Too, and we found some great food and some really interesting characters.
And amiable people.
All very amiable, as the Irish are known to be, and all very welcoming and all that good stuff. So we're starting out with three rather different personalities and places for you today, and in the next 2 to 3 weeks you'll have a whole lot more.
I mean, we can start with Ross Lewis, who he is such a great chef. He could pop himself into London,
Paris, New York,
and wherever. He still would be at the top of the stack of
and such a thoughtful man, and not only that, but
as well as
a delightful personality, a successful businessman who's had a restaurant in the same place for almost 20 years, and
which
it's
is
called
remarkable. Yeah.
And it's called Chapter One. So we'll get the story of Chapter One and Ross Lewis coming right up.
Thoughtful, provocative, satisfying, and delicious are adjectives I could use to describe the meal we had last night, and I will. We are at Chapter One, a very fine restaurant and a beautiful restaurant, which we'll talk about in a little bit, in Dublin, talking to chef owner Ross Lewis, who is responsible for this wonderful meal that we had. And besides that, you're fun to talk to. Welcome to On the Menu, Ross.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very flattered by that introduction, so very glad
it's
to be here.
It's very true, though. Let's jump back a little bit. This is 20 years old.
20 years. Our 20th year will be complete this February. So it's one could say I'm pretty much it's been a marathon, not a sprint. So, And I think that anyone who's achieved the level of success to keep a restaurant open 20 years knows that you have to continually evolve and you have to reinterpret what you're doing, and it's a very hard thing. So you need to take the long-term approach to that, because I suppose people always ask me, what's a successful restaurant? And I say, well, that's one that's open for 10 years.
Exactly. We've not been to, and I don't know that we're going to get to, the Writers Museum, which is upstairs. But it's so logical calling it Chapter One. But are there any other reasons why you have association with Chapter One?
No, not really. We were established underneath the Dublin Writers Museum, a very fine Georgian building, former home of John Jameson, who's from the famous whiskey-making family. And we were actually not the first operators, but we came in a year after the first operators had it and left. And it was called Chapter One at the time. And as you probably know, it's the same all over the world. When you have your liquor licenses and restaurant licenses all tied into a name, then you're slow enough to change them, especially if you had such a low budget as we had. So having not too much money, we came in here, and we were only, I think the zeal of youth brought me in here at the age of 26 and a half, I think. And we just worked very hard and put one foot in front of the other, and a very long, slow, evolving journey to where we find ourselves today. So Chapter One is the first chapter, and I think at this stage it's probably going to be the only chapter.
Well, I mean, it's quite a very rich chapter, let's put it that way. And it's a very busy restaurant. We've been here various times of the day, afternoon, evening, and it's always sort of jumping.
Yeah, we're very lucky, I suppose, even given the current economic backdrop in Ireland, which is none too positive. We've been able to maintain a certain level of business throughout the recession of the last 3 years. And I suppose having a very large clientele or custom base built up over 20 years, we were really, our ethos was defined by our location. And we're kind of, something that you may not know about Chapter One is we're kind of on the left bank at the moment. So it was not a natural resting place for a restaurant of this caliber. So we always found that we had to work extremely hard to attract people up here because it's a destination, and as the kind of end of the city wasn't favourable when we opened it in the early 90s. The more favourable areas, of course, around Stephen's Green, etc., which is where all the commercial activity and the high-end boutiques and shops are. So our ethos was defined by the fact that we had to work very hard, give people a warmer welcome, be consistent with our product, and not rip people off. So we always maintained very reasonable levels of price. But what we did do is we increased the quality of what we had on offer and our service over 20 years.
Your service is incredible, isn't it? It seems like there are people everywhere trying to help and do whatever they need to do.
Yeah, well, I think that Chapter 1, its success is... Because it's a sum of the parts restaurant. It's not a temple to gastronomy, and so we work very hard to make sure that the service is as important, I think, and a warm welcome is essential, and that is the kind of hallmark of Chapter 1, is that we do a reasonably high end product that is consistent using quality Irish ingredients with a very warm welcome and an informal but friendly, efficient service.
And you feel good being in this space. Now, I asked you, you apparently started out more bare bones than this. This is a really beautifully designed space. Now, you said that you actually had it totally top to bottom redone three years ago. Tell us about that.
Well, we were here 17 years, and for the last 7 or 8 years, we've been pretty much full all the time. And we came to a juncture where we decided that we would have to upgrade the product and change it, and that would give us the advantage to continue trading for the next 10 years, hopefully, without doing too much else. And we engaged in a renovation of the restaurant where we gave back part of the kitchen, which is a vaulted Georgian vault area, and we gave that back to the restaurant, opened it up as reception. And we opened up the restaurant a lot. It was a very compartmentalized because it's a basement. And essentially, when we opened it up, it gave it kind of the depth and dimension, give something atmosphere. So after that, I said, well, that's great. The restaurant looks good. I've got to do the kitchen. Am I going to do the A job or the B job? So I got carried away like all chefs do. And for me, the kitchen that I put up, I suppose, is the result of a lifetime's dream. I'm, continually going to high-end restaurants throughout the world, Europe, etc., and seeing that the way they bring the design of the restaurant right through into the kitchen. And so we've opened up our kitchen, we've put a table in there, and we've softened the kitchen, because most kitchens are white tiles and ultraviolet lights and stainless steel, and it's a very industrial or male type of a atmosphere and backdrop. So we softened it with a nice chocolate brown tile and a lovely chef's table that has a chocolate brown volcanic rock tabletop, and
we loved it. And we overlooked the kitchen, of course, but directly overlooked the pastry station.
Yeah,
I wanted to know how many macaroons that man made.
A lot is the answer. So we put up what you would consider a reasonably high-end kitchen. I brought in natural materials. We brought in some marble and smoked glass and burnished copper and some wood, et cetera, et cetera. But the overall design, we wanted to, I suppose, achieve a restaurant that was... design of a restaurant is very important for the atmosphere of a restaurant.
Yes.
And restaurateurs sometimes don't understand that. And so I was very cautious to move forward, to modernize it, but to make sure we retained the atmosphere and made sure it was comfortable yet modern and elegant. And I gave my interior architect a size 9 pain in the you-know-what, dogging her for 3 years. And when I say to you, over 3 years, we did the restaurant and the kitchen and every other aspect, from the cloakrooms, the toilets, we did it slowly and methodically. And I did it with her holding my hand, or me holding her hand, which she wasn't too impressed with initially. But once she understood the passion and where I was coming from and the commitment that I'd put into the restaurant, we became particularly good friends. And I would say I put 8 to 10 hours a week for 3 years into the whole project, aside from cooking. So very time-consuming, but very rewarding at the same time.
Well, I mean, the result is really stunning. So Now,
thank you.
Who actually ends up coming here? Locals?
Yeah, well, I suppose the hallmark of Chapter 1, and people have been asking me over the years, who are your customers? And I would always shoot back at them. We get a lot of people who buy their own dinner. And that's very important. Because you get a lot of corporate people who don't. And in good times you see them, and in bad times, like at the moment, you don't see them. So we have a combination of some businessmen. We're very close to the Gate Theatre and the Abbey Theatre, which is the National Theatre. And on a nightly basis, we would do between 40 and 50 from those theatres.
Pre-theatre.
Yeah. We get an awful lot of people who come here once a year for a birthday or an anniversary. Uh-huh. And I'm talking thousands of people. And every night when I go out and I do the room, you would be absolutely guaranteed that there would be between 5 and 10 tables every night celebrating something. And these are the people that we didn't exclude during the good times, because we always had... You were as likely to get as warm a welcome in Chapter 1 if you were driving a bus than if you were a CEO of a big company. I have to say, Martin, my partner, is extremely democratic when it comes to a welcome and service. And so we have a lot of people who possibly save up, and once a year they come here. So,
well, I'll tell you, it's worth it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about, if someone's coming here, what kind of food to expect?
I suppose the hallmark of our cooking is that, I think that my development has been as a chef in a very hands-on role, and a lot of it has been self-development. I came to cooking at 21, and I was cooking only 4 years when I came in here. So as the man says, you think you know it all at that age, but you're looking back at it and reflecting, didn't know anything. You know anything. So,
did you have formal training or not?
Just 4 years, 2 or 3 different restaurants. So the rest has been a journey of great self-finding out and making mistakes and the experience of cooking. And I don't know how it happens to other chefs, but for me it came, there was a clearing in the last 7 or 8 years where I really started to understand exactly what I was doing. And I can now see food very distinctively, put it together instinctively. Very often from an idea in my head, I can write down a complete dish, and getting it right a lot more often than we're getting it wrong, So, and we have a lot of local good produce. I've worked 20 years in developing relationships with artisans, and so they come to my back door. And so that my biggest influence, I know this is very cliched, but it is the people and the passion of the small producers that I interact with on a yearly basis.
But we were talking last night about your global travels. So you're seeking out what the rest of the world is doing.
Yeah.
You said you were just recently at Noma, and you're going to Osteria Franciscana, and you've been to El Bulli, mm-hmm. and you've been to Arzak, and you've been to Mugaritz, and I'm sure you have other places in mind as well. So you're picking up ideas when you go
Absolutely,
there as well.
Absolutely, yeah. What I primarily influenced by how I have reflected on food over the 20 years and how I've moved on, and the people and produce around me. But I travel to see the products or the great restaurants of the world, of the great chefs, some of which we've just mentioned. But what it gives me is stimulation.
Yes.
And there's no case for any chef, I think, at my stage of the career, where you're going to go and copy what somebody else
right.
is doing. But you get enlightenment. You might see a system of service. You might see anything from crockery, the technology, technologically how they put their food together. And of course, at this stage, for me, it's reasonably easy to disseminate that and to understand what they're doing. And so I'm taking away a lot of inspiration, and I suppose that some ideas in terms of style of ideas as opposed to the substance, or recreating what they're doing. And that's very important. But as well, for me, I would work very hard. And one of the aspects of this business I look forward to, one is I love the great large food family, and I'm basically a very, I come from an agricultural background, and I love food, the terroir of food, and the people involved in food, because they're so passionate. And I often say to people, people might go to a restaurant, they say, you know, you can buy that bottle of wine in a store for X amount. And no. I say, yeah, but, you know, they're not going to open it for you and lay a table and put the silverware down, etc. And difference between buying food in a restaurant and buying it in a store is that there's an emotional exchange in the restaurant. And the emotional exchange starts when you first ring the doorbell and somebody greets you right through to escort you back out, hopefully having you paid the bill to the street. And as I say, we give a lot of emotional exchange to our customers. So what I love about dealing with the great food family and the great producers and small people is that they're passionate. And I need that emotional exchange to support me because I give a lot of it to our customers. And so that's very important.
You do. And you're so warm. But the thing that intrigued me the most is your dishes are so intricate and so inventive. And I said to you last night, where does this come from? How do you get all these ideas? And you said that your mind was going all the time.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you're dreaming of recipes. You know, Peter asked you if you kept a little pad next to the your bed so you could get up in the middle of the night with an idea, and you said yes.
Absolutely. I mean, my wife would find various dishes strewn around the house from places like the bathroom to the bedroom, tableside, the breakfast table, etc., etc. But I suppose you know, somebody said to me something funny years ago, and, you know, it said, like, out of routine comes innovation, and there is a sense of that. Because the routine for me is that dealing with artisan food producers, and somebody rings me and said, I'm coming in with sweet corn for 6 weeks, or I've got damsons, I've built up a... Once I have all this store of produce around me, and then thinking about how they interact, and so I'm looking at what's around me, and I'm thinking, okay, flavor combinations that work. So you just really... You're working on that all the time. You're broadening it out. And it's something that gets easier for me now at the stage I'm at in my career with the experience I have and the hindsight than what it did 10 or 15 years ago. I don't know how it is for other chefs, but that's how it is for me. And I would consider that at the moment, you know, in terms of putting together food and dishes, I would say this is probably my peak. If there is such a thing, I feel great. I feel I can go on for some more years. I'm still young, but I have to say that I feel it's the strongest that I have been professionally as a chef.
Well, this is strong. Absolutely. Can you pick just a few dishes that we can sort of run through for listeners? Which of these would you start with?
Well, I think you started last night with the flavors tomato. So, I mean, with the salted damsons, what I do is, you know, we don't have a calendar or a clock, but we have the seasons, and I know what time of the year it is from what comes in. And this time of the year, you've got great tomatoes. So taking great tomatoes, you say, okay, you know, we're going to play with some flavors of tomato. So on the bottom, I have a raw tomato consomme that has been slightly set with gelatin. And then we have on top of that, we've got small cherry tomatoes, some dried tomato. We have got some salted damsons, and damsons are almost like a wild plum.
They're very popular in the UK.
Okay. And we salted them, but it's slightly sweet but more acidic. So I like the way that flavor combines with the kind of the acidity and the sweetness of tomato. We brought some coriander in there because pretty much goes well with tomato.
And that was not the seed, but the fresh green cilantro.
There was a tiny little micro herb of coriander that was three pieces, and there was also some coriander oil. And I have some fried onion bread, which we use here as one of our breads that we use.
Yeah, you
at
make
night.
All of your own breads,
make all
we should
our own
say.
Breads,
and
yeah.
we went crazy over your dark
brown bread, soda bread, yeah.
That's soda bread, the brown.
Yeah, our traditional Irish soda bread, which is...
Well, that's why everybody loves it.
Yeah, you've
like
got
that.
To serve it in
I
restaurants.
I mean, I've had soda bread that doesn't taste like that.
You got to have soda bread in Ireland, you know. It's one of those breads you just have to serve. People come to Ireland and they're like, where's your soda bread? Soda bread, you know, and that's the way it is. So we do we do a very nice whole wheat sourdough, a soda bread, and an onion bread. It's kind of almost It's a meat pan with onion in it. And so that's where that bread comes from. We're obviously reusing from that, slicing it thinly and just cooking it in some clarified butter. So I have a slight dusting of yuzu salt over that. And yuzu, as you know, is Japanese yuzu. It's slightly fragrant, almost citrusy, lemongrassy. And so it adds that adds another dimension. But essentially, there's also a little bit of Irish creme fraiche from West Cork that we flavoured with tomato essence. So you have that creaminess. So you have the clean acidity of tomatoes, the saltiness, the damsons, the sweetness of tomatoes, a little bit of cream flavour in your mouth from the flavoured creme fraiche. And then you have coriander. And then just for a different texture, obviously, you have the dried and fresh tomatoes with crunchy brown bread. So it's all decorated with little porridge flowers.
Than that, yeah. You know, well, truly.
And all of that, listeners, is 4 bites.
Delicious.
So, yeah. So at the end of the meal, there was more substantial. You had something that was, two things that were really exciting. Some lamb. But yeah. Some very special lamb. Tell us about that.
Well, we have here in Ireland an area of Ireland called Connemara. It's a province or a county, and it's there in the northwest. And it's a particularly hilly and barren region, and it's no better place, I suppose, than to let sheep graze the mountains. So we have an Appellation. They're working on a kind of an AC, an Appellation Control A, for Connemara Hill lamb, which is basically a lamb which are allowed to roam the mountains, and they eat a lot of the very lush green grass and the scrub. And so the season for them starts a bit later than our traditional lamb, and that starts in July and runs through to December. And it's a smaller, leaner lamb, but has great, great flavour. And of course, Ireland is, I suppose, known as a grass-based agricultural system. And if you can have the best grass in the world, then you should be able to have some of the best lamb and beef and dairy, butter, milk. If you have the best milk, you can have the best cheese. So, you know, that's the kind of food landscape in Ireland, along with the wonderful fish we get from the west coast of Ireland, amazing shellfish, etc., etc. So we're not like the Mediterranean countries where everything grows above ground, but, you know, that's why our cooking is rooted in root veg and lamb and beef and etc., etc. So this lamb dish is, the rump of it is cooked under vacuum seal with some hay and rubbed with garlic oil. The neck is cooked for 12 hours at 90 degrees in its own juices, and we bring that together on the plate. The rump is cooked till pink, the neck is glazed, and the sauce is a pickled garlic sauce with a light lamb jus is montéd with some garlic oil and pickled garlic juice with some chopped pickled garlic. You have some carrots cooked in honey and black pepper, caper sprout cream, and we bring that all together with a smoked champ potato, which is very important because it acts as something that mops all the other flavors together, and it's just a nice, earthy, rustic, flavorsome, homely dish.
Wow, it was absolutely delicious. I wanted to mention that we said, of course, all the bread is made in-house, but one of the things we had was selections from the charcuterie trolley.
Yeah.
And we should mention that almost all of your charcuterie is done in-house as well.
Yes, right? Absolutely, yeah. In our endeavour to keep the service staff, put them in part of the lineup and make sure that, you know, I think that what happened, the chef some years ago, they made the waiter just a plate carrier, where they just asked to take a plate from the hot plate to the customer. And we decided here a long time ago, because we used to do a lot of Irish coffees at the table, that we need to do more restaurant service, that it's interesting for the customer.
Oh,
it's part of the theatre. That's why we have a very large, lovely Art Deco silver trolley that we use for maybe main courses for two, such as suckling pork, etc., which came out of the Savoy Hotel. It was built in 1948. We have a bread trolley, which we carve the breads in the front of the customers. We do Irish coffees in the front of the customer. And the one of the additions was the charcuterie trolley. And we thought it would be great to be able to make our own charcuterie and serve 3 or 4 or 5 different types of charcuterie, some hot, some cold, with their own accompaniments off a trolley to the customer at the table, at the restaurant. And it has worked out to being very popular, and I suppose it's become one of our signature dishes. And last night you had a pig's trotter boudin, which came with some green raisins, which are in a Madeira jus. Had some potted rabbit and ham, which has been cooked down with in Pinot Gris and jellied with mace and foie gras terrine with a Madeira jelly on it and some ice wine verjus gel. And then you have some gubin salami, which had celeriac remoulade in it. And that's made, the only thing that we don't make here is made by Fingal Ferguson in West Cork. So very fine, one of the first very fine artisan salami makers in Ireland. It's all served, of course, with a toasted sourdough. So for somebody who likes to eat their dinner in the middle of the day, that's for sure. You've got to have a serious appetite, but it has nice kind of homely, diverse flavors, and everything has a different accompaniment, and people really enjoy it here.
Well, can't tell you, Chef Ross, how exciting dining here is. For us, it was very exciting. It was sort of the top of the week, I would say, very clearly. And I wish we could be back here again frequently.
Well, you're welcome anytime.
Well, thank you also for taking time to talk to us. And
no,
hopefully our paths will keep crossing.
Absolutely. May I say it's been a pleasure meeting you both. And I know last night we had one of those great congenial, convivial food family chats that you can only have with people who have the kind of passion. And those people are normally the people involved in the food business. And long may that last. And thank you very much for coming.
I wish we could go to Chapter 1 and have dinner with Ross tonight.
But yeah, me too.
But we're going to have to be satisfied with whatever Peter can conjure up. It's actually going to be
beer can chicken
tonight, which is something
far
Ross...
Far cry from Chapter 1.
Indeed. But now, of course, it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We've moved out of Dublin per se, but we're still in the relative southeastern area.
Yeah, they say it's only 30 minutes from downtown Dublin to, well, I don't know that you'd call it a palace exactly, but it's pretty close to one.
It's the place is Powers Court, and the setting, the natural setting, the rolling gardens and the working gardens as well are totally breathtaking, as is the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, which is where we stayed, it took luxury to the extreme. It was beautiful.
It turns out that I think an opportunity presented itself when there was a major disaster on the site at the Powers Court Mansion itself. It was gutted by fire. The gardens are fully regrown, and they're doing some restoration of the Powers Court Mansion itself. But somewhere along the way, they had the brilliant idea of asking someone if they'd like to put a luxury resort on the property, and who better
to
do that?
So they did.
Who better to do that than Ritz-Carlton? So we've got a lineup.
Yeah, may I though mention before you stray from the issue of this 35,000 square foot spa that had me fixated, although I didn't get past using the exercise bike. They did have a black marble swimming pool embedded, studded with illuminated Swarovski crystals. Now you tell me, has there been anything more luxurious presented our path to date? No.
I don't know. We stayed at some pretty good places, but I can't remember one that's better than Powers Court. So here are several spokespeople to talk about staying and dining at Powers Court.
Well, I'm going to start by saying that we're at Powers Court, at the Ritz-Carlton at Powers Court, and then secondly, I will say we are at Gordon Ramsay restaurant at Powers Court, but we're going to have an introduction a little bit about place itself so that you understand why we're enthralled here. Jill, can you join us? Introduce yourself.
Absolutely. My name is Jill O'Hare, and I'm the Director of Sales and Marketing here at the Ritz-Carlton in Powers Court. And the hotel is located deep in the heart of Powers Court Estate, which dates back to the 18th century. It was the former home of the Earl of Powers Court, and it's 1,000 acres in size.
And gorgeous.
And absolutely gorgeous. So the hotel is located within the domain, looking out over the most most beautiful panoramic of the Wicklow countryside. But the beauty of it is the fact that it's only 30 minutes from downtown Dublin. So you can really enjoy the best of both worlds here. The luscious Irish countryside and the nightlife that Dublin has to offer.
Not only that, but the what goes along with the name Ritz-Carlton. The good taste, the luxury.
And absolutely the service, which is what the Ritz-Carlton is all about.
And I have not yet seen, but I can hardly wait to see, the swimming pool lined with Swarovski crystals.
That's my second favorite part of the hotel. My favorite part of the hotel is our traditional Irish pub, McGill's, because every Irish girl's heart and every Irish man's heart really is in the pub. So the Swarovski crystal pool comes in at number two.
So you grew up near here, so...
I grew up in a town called Drogheda, which is located just about 30 miles north of Dublin in the county of Louth, which is known as the Wee County. It's the smallest county in Ireland, and it's just on the border between Northern Ireland and Dublin.
Now, what about Ritz-Carlton website? Is that the best place to start to get some idea of the, oh, such an array of luxurious, I mean, everything, the spa, the...
Everything is on there. If you go to www.ritzcarlton.com/Powers Court, you will get information on absolutely everything relating to this hotel, from the food and beverage options to the meeting space to the wedding opportunities to the leisure options. Absolutely everything is there. It's a really good first place to start.
Even falconry. Peter said he wasn't interested in falconry.
It's a popular sport for visitors to Ireland, believe it or not.
I believe it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we have also with us, because what we do is we eat, don't we, a lot. We have the executive chef, Eric Meloche, from the Gordon Ramsay restaurant. And we have the chef de cuisine, Peter Byrne, which is a good Irish name. And we're going to talk to them a little bit about what to expect from the restaurant scene here. Now, starting with Eric, you're Canadian. You are not Irish.
That is true. I'm Canadian.
From?
From Windsor, Ontario.
And how did you get here and what? Why?
Well, I actually did all my training, obviously, in Canada, out west at the Banff Springs Hotel. And then in 2003, I joined the Ritz-Carlton Company in Amelia Island in Florida.
Oh, I see. Amelia Island. Yeah, we know tons of people who have gone to
Amelia
Island.
That's a beautiful place.
Yeah.
Yeah, very fortunate to work there. And then from there, I transferred to Jamaica. After that, I went to the Ritz-Carlton in Half Moon Bay, which is in California. And from there, I ended up in Ireland. So I've been here now for about 16 months.
Okay, so you've come through the Ritz-Carlton scene.
I have, yeah.
Great. You like Ireland?
Oh, I do. I enjoy it. It's a beautiful country. The people are great. Food offering, the product that we get to work with is phenomenal.
That's what all the chefs say.
It's great.
They love it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely great. All of our menus here at the Ritz-Carlton Powers Court are product driven. Work with clean flavors and try to keep things simple and let the product speak for itself.
And Peter, you are native Irish, right?
I am indeed. I'm from a little village called Shankill in County Dublin.
I love your accent.
You don't love mine?
You sound almost like me until you say out. you came through how to get here?
I worked in a restaurant called Chapter One Restaurant, which has won numerous awards for best restaurant in Ireland. I was a senior sous chef there for 7.5 years, and then I came out to the Ritz-Carlton Powers Court about 4 months ago.
And the fun thing is that, of course, on this trip we interviewed your ex-boss, but the even funner thing is that he chose to come here for dinner just a couple of nights ago.
He did, yeah.
So you must still be friends, and he must think you cook okay, I guess.
Well, that's what he came out to check, just to make sure. And if everything wasn't up to standard as he's trained me, he would have let me know. But there was good reports back from him. He was very happy.
Now, did you just go right into kitchens to work, or did you go to, like, Ballymaloe or someplace?
I didn't go to Ballymaloe, but I went to a college in the city centre called Dublin Institute of Technology, which I did a professional cookery course there. And then on from there, I went to a couple of other hotels and then restaurants and then Chapter One.
Aha. Well, of course, we love Chapter One, but we're going to love this too. Let's go back. Eric, what kinds of things actually pushed you into a culinary career?
Well, I guess really it was just my passion to work in the kitchen. It was always the funnest thing for me to do. Out of high school, I actually went to university to study biology, but I was paying my way through school by cooking.
Right, that happens a lot.
Yeah, actually. It happens a lot. And, you know, they say that this career chooses you, you don't choose it. And it's, in fact, what kind of happened with me. So I just, it was what I was meant to do, and I just fell in love with it, and I've been doing it ever since.
of course, it helps a lot that chefs are now so significant in our social fabric, huh?
Yeah, things have changed a lot. I think media has played a huge part in that. And just overall, I think people are more interested in food than they used to be. And people know a lot more about food, which is great for us.
Yeah, and we've interviewed people who have cooking classes for children, like little children.
Right. Well, the Ritz-Carlton actually is in the process of launching a healthy kids cookbook, where all of the executive chefs from around the world have submitted recipes for healthy dishes for kids.
Oh, that's great.
So it's going to be compiled and released next year.
Now, Peter, how did you get into this cooking business?
I've always loved food. My father was a great cook, so he always teach me at home. The main turning point was when I was in school. They send you to do work experience for 2 weeks during the year, and I went to work in a hotel restaurant. And ever from there, I haven't stopped. From
do
the
you
age
like
of 16.
The adrenaline? Is that a lot of chefs say they love the showtime?
Yeah, I grew up playing sports my whole life, and to me, cooking is a lot like, and working in the kitchen is a lot like a sporting like a game. It's intense, and definitely you get the adrenaline rush. And
it's like a hobby to me as well, because I love it so much. And I just feel if you really didn't love cooking, you wouldn't want to be in a kitchen 16 hours a day or 14 hours a day working and not doing something that you don't love.
Right.
Which is the main.
How about mentors? Do you have particular mentors?
The main one for me would have been Russ Lewis from Chapter One. He was the one that really showed me how to cook properly and how to put flavors together on the plate and not to overly confuse dishes and make sure everything tastes good.
Yeah, and for me, I've had a few in my career, but probably the most notable would have been Xavier Salomon. He's the executive chef of the Ritz-Carlton in Half Moon Bay. I think the biggest thing I learned in Half Moon Bay was, you know, the whole farm-to-table, product-driven sustainability. You're living right in the middle of all that farmland right on the coast. You really see how the product can be, you know, how you don't really need to do a lot to the product to enhance it and just focus on the natural flavor and things that are in season and local to put the best dishes together.
Were either of you seduced by the science kitchen stuff?
We used a little bit. Are you talking about molecular gastronomy
and
things like that?
Yeah, except we're not allowed to call it that anymore.
Right. It's obviously extremely exciting and amazing what, you know, some chefs are doing. I wouldn't say it really applies too much at our hotel. Concepts in our restaurants are more kind of approachable and, again, product-driven and really just focusing on accentuating the flavors of the product and letting it speak for itself.
And what about the new directions with this, the new, not Scandinavian, what do they call it, the new Nordic cuisine? I mean, are you scraping moss off your trees yet?
Not yet. We do some foraging here. We have a lot that grows here on the estate, from wild mushrooms in the fall to, you know, wild garlic in the spring. So we do a bit of foraging, but we haven't started scraping any trees just yet.
You have plenty of it.
Yeah, we certainly do.
You have a lot of raw material. Gordon Ramsay is certainly a strong brand, and his influence among various establishments in his empire, I've discovered, varies. Could you tell us just how much interaction there is between this restaurant and Gordon Ramsay, and what kind of influences he has on this menu and your food?
There is a lot of interaction between the Ritz-Carlton Powers Gordon and Gordon Ramsay Holdings in London. He'd be a frequent flyer over here. He would come here a few times a year, and we would be in regular contact with him or his executive chefs from London in regards to changing the menus. If we were changing some dishes, we'd have to email the recipes over, email photos, so we wouldn't be able to change that unless we've got to go ahead from the guys in London themselves.
Yeah, we usually do a catch-up call every, you know, once a week with Simon Gregory. He's the executive chef for the Gordon Ramsay Holdings over there. Although Simon's from Australia, and he hasn't called us recently, and I'm not sure if that has anything to do with Ireland's decisive victory over Australia in the World Cup. But Simon, if you're listening, sorry about that. But we have a great relationship with the gentleman over there. Yeah, we talk a lot about food, about what we want to do with the menus and things like that, and new trends in London, things like that. So that's great.
Well, that's great to know. I guess I should ask you first, this is not an economy hotel operation. Who actually are your food customers? Who comes to your restaurants?
Well, I would say it's a wide variety. We have everything from people celebrating their wedding anniversaries to families celebrating a christening, to locals coming in just to have dinner on a Tuesday night, and then from Dublin coming out on the weekend just to spend some time in Powers Court Estate.
Do they come to eat or do they also stay?
Both, yeah. But we have a high number of both people obviously coming to stay, and but then also people just coming in to dine. And,
yeah, I mean, I'm amazed about this kids program. You know, you have all these, what is this chess set out there? And
Yeah, there's a lot of activities. The kids have a good time here. And actually, we do cooking classes for kids as well. We had a girl in here the other day, and it was her birthday. And so her parents surprised her with a cookie-making class in the pastry shop with our pastry chef, Ludovic Lantier, which obviously she was blown away.
How old was the little girl?
She was 12.
Oh, that's a good age. That's
really
good.
And then her parents had dinner on the chef's table that night.
Oh, yeah, and let's mention that, the chef's table. It's right in the kitchen.
Oh, it's beautiful. It seats 12 people. It's right in the kitchen.
Is it closed off like Chapter 1 with the glass walls?
No. It's
right
completely
there.
Open.
Yeah, completely open. I love that. We ate at the chef's table, Peter, and we had a great time because everyone can pop in and talk to you.
Yeah, it's a great experience for people to go and sit in the chef's table and experience how everything's done right in front of them. The chef's table here, it's about 2 meters away from the kitchen. So you can hear all the hustle and bustle of the kitchen and see how everything's done, everything's organized.
A lot of swearing.
Not here.
No swearing allowed.
No swearing allowed.
Well, let's turn our attention to, now, I think, Peter, you're responsible for this menu. Is that correct, Eric? Going to have him do it, or who's going to do? I'd like to just have our listeners, just if you could walk us through some special dishes, and they could get an idea of your approach to food and what they might consider eating. Who wants to start?
Yeah, go for it, Peter.
I'll go ahead. My approach to food would be to let the produce speak for itself. I don't like doing fussy food. I'd like to keep it fairly simple and, as I said, let the flavour speak for itself. A lot of the food we have on the menu would come from County Wicklow. For example, the pork main course we have, we'd get a half a pig in every week, and we would use the belly, the rack, and the cheeks as well. And we'd make a sausage from the shoulder. Also the lamb shoulder we have on, which comes...
Oh yeah, that looks wonderful. Tell us about that.
The lamb shoulder comes from a place in County Wicklow called Dunlavin, which is about 25 minutes away from the Ritz-Carlton. So we would order it straight from the farm. It would come to us, and we would braise it at 70 degrees for 12 hours.
So do you have an immersion circulator? Or?
We just do it in the oven.
Oh, in the oven.
So once it comes out, we'd press it, and it's real melting the mouth. It's beautiful.
And how about this suckling pig ravioli that looks really good?
Suckling pig ravioli is very good. It's bound with a small bit of chicken mousse and some fresh lemon zest in it and sage. And a nice little bit of saffron pasta with some mushroom and artichoke. And the mushrooms come from the Powers Court estate itself.
Here?
Yeah.
So if we look at the divisions here, you've got your starters, and that's anything anybody would want from, and it's almost all local, like Castletown Bear. Crab cocktail, chilled Irish lobster. I just had the best lobster I've had in my life the other day here. Then you have a section called From the Grill, where you do the chops and the steaks and the...
Yeah, we have a char grill in the kitchen, where we would do the sirloin, the rib, the rump and the lamb chops, and then the calf's liver and the Ferguson's bacon.
Calf's liver.
Yeah.
And again, all the producers' names are here. It's Ferguson's smoked bacon. And then you have your mains. Relatively accessible number. I mean, it's not an overwhelming menu. It's contemporary in the sense that it is accessible, and it changes quite frequently, I understand.
It does. Yeah. With every season, it changes, yeah.
Right. And then you have side orders. And triple cooked chips sound really good. And then you have a whole lineup of desserts, which is including some cheeses. Now, everything's made in-house?
Everything's made in-house.
Yeah. And bread, too?
Bread, too. We make all of our bread, all of our macaroons, all of our petit fours, everything from scratch.
What is the most iconic thing on this? Oh, yeah, Peter just asked me, do you do a tasting menu?
Yes, we do a tasting menu, mainly on weekends.
Okay.
Mainly on weekends we have it.
Okay. Anyhow, and we haven't mentioned the wine program. Let's talk about that a little bit. What kind of wines do you have? I have a big folder here. So you have an extensive cellar, huh?
We do. We have the, I don't know how many bottles exactly are in the cellar, but we have our sommelier around the corner if you'd like.
Oh, you have a sommelier as well?
Yeah, his name is Graziano.
Oh, he's the Graziano we met. He's from Sardinia.
He is indeed.
Which is, their wines are coming up.
Well, while you're mentioning wine, I think it's important for people to know that we actually have a wine bar. This is a wine bar where we're sitting.
That's where we're sitting.
That's right. So it opens at 3 p.m. We feature wines by the glass, but we also feature local artisan cheeses, as well as charcuterie from Gubian Smokehouse. He's a gentleman by the name of Fingal Ferguson, and he makes a variety of
salamis.
He's
been on every good restaurant's
exactly,
menu.
Yeah. Fabulous. Well, he does a great product. We're lucky to have it here in the wine bar.
Yeah, and I wanted to say that although Gordon Ramsay is generally viewed as a very upscale name in the business, there's a certain relaxed quality about this restaurant that I've sensed even before I've had dinner.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, we want people to feel comfortable. We still consider the food to be casual, approachable fine dining, so the product is great, but we want a comfortable atmosphere where you can come in a pair of jeans and a t-shirt and have a great meal if that's what you want to do.
Oh, great. And so now we have our wine guy. Do you want to introduce yourself and go?
Good evening. My name is Graziano. I joined the Ritz-Carlton in May. I used to work in the Four Seasons, so basically I'm going to explain the wine list.
Exactly. What's on it? How many bottles? I mean, what?
So we released over 700 bottles, and we have three different wine cellars. The wine list, obviously, we lower down the prices. We have a selection of wines by the glass, and starting from €5, which is very unusual.
€5
only by the glass, yeah, which is the Trebbiano d'Abruzzo. And the most expensive wine by the glass, it's €12. So it's a very reasonable price.
And is it a global list? I mean, it's what kind of labels? Italian?
Yeah,
French?
We have wines from all over the world. Most of the wines are from France and Italy. But we have very good wines from Spain as well. We have good Rioja.
And I bet you have some Cannonau on there, huh?
Cannonau, exactly. We have actually two wines from Sardinia. One is the Vermentino,
okay,
which is probably the most famous wine in Sardinia, and the Cannonau, which is a very strong.
I think the Cannonau is the most famous.
Cannonau is probably the most famous. Yeah.
The Vermentino is the most familiar.
Yeah, exactly.
And we had a wonderful time in Sardinia probably 12 to 14 years ago, and we know that the quality has been raised since then, as it has in many parts of Italy. But what are some of your favorite places for wine, aside from Italy?
Probably France.
Bordeaux, Burgundy?
Bordeaux region, yeah. I like Pinot Noir from the Burgundy region.
Okay, well, doesn't everybody? Everybody loves Pinot Noir, including people who try to grow the grapes.
Yeah,
and get very frustrated about that sometimes. Now, I think, didn't somebody tell us that there were some people experimenting with trying to grow grapes in Ireland? I think somebody told us that over the last few days.
Yeah, on the west coast, if I'm not wrong.
Okay.
With the global warming.
which global warming is that? It's 55 degrees today, and he couldn't make up his mind whether to rain or shine.
To be honest, I never tried the Irish wines.
No, I don't
know if Peter tried.
No, there isn't.
I don't think I would be lining up to do that either.
No.
But we're going to challenge you this evening, I hope.
Absolutely.
I hope you'll join us and play our game.
We're looking forward.
Because On the Menu loves... The game On the Menu loves is tasting menus and people doing all the work of trying to figure out what wines go with them, because we know that as people coming in from the outside, we don't have a chance to understand what you have on your list. So perhaps you'll play the game with us this evening?
Absolutely. Looking forward to match all the wines.
So Graziano, thank you so much for joining us, and let's everybody say goodbye to wrap up.
I want to thank everybody, Jill, Peter, Eric, Graziano. This has been a very enlightening segment, and I can't wait to taste the food and drink the wine. Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming to visit us.
Thank you very much.
Well, I really wish we could have recorded through the whole meal. We had our dinner at the chef's table in the kitchen, and it really is a wooden table designed to seat 12, but two of us sat there. And
we felt like the king and queen.
We did, and watched everybody and Peter Byrne was chefing, and he took great care of us and introduced all the dishes to us, and everything was delicious. Absolutely.
Yeah, what can we say? There's only one. I know. There's only two words we can use. Go there.
Go there.
Go
and,
there.
And now we have to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We had another really exciting experience at Ballymaloe House, which was in itself quite charming. But the real thrill was, you may have heard of this renaissance in Irish cooking. And we met the icon who started it all, Myrtle Allen. Would she mind if I said her age, or do you think?
Let's put it this way. It's a lot.
Yeah, and she's still going strong, and she's just absolutely a gorgeous woman. And she views her role as very simple. She said she was a farmer's wife. Well, she certainly was a lot more than a farmer's wife. And she started a dynasty of really brilliant Irish cooks. Let's listen to Myrtle. Here we are at Ballymaloe House, and thrilled to be here and to be talking to the founder of this great new tradition of contemporary, modern, basic, good, whatever you want to call it, Irish cuisine. We're talking to the woman who is the founder of the whole movement towards modern Irish cuisine, but she's also referred to as the first Mrs. Allen. We're talking to Myrtle Allen, and welcome, please, to On the Menu Radio, Myrtle.
Thank you. Well, I have two more Mrs. Allens up my sleeve.
It's wonderful how you all ended up being great cooks.
Well, it's very funny. You can't say it's hereditary because none of us are related. The only thing that might point to some hereditary influence is that the Allen boys all like good food. And they choose somebody and then prime them at what they want.
Well, the house we're staying in now is... it's a restaurant and it's a guest house. You even have a section where you can self-cater, I understand. Activities outside, beautiful estate, your own gardens. But this was actually a family home and it has an interesting history. Could you tell us how this all got started?
Well, if you go back to the very beginning, it was started as a Norman castle, 15th century, 16th or 15th century. I haven't been able to find a record of its being built.
But we have pieces of the walls in the halls I saw.
Yes, you can. There is a date on the wall, you may see it. Lord Mountjoy, the British, was he an admiral or a general? I'm not certain. He had won, more or less, the Battle of Kinsale. He came here for his first night to Ballymaloe. He stayed here, Mountjoy. And the people who lived here were, I suppose you call them Anglo-Normans.
Okay.
They probably had Irish blood, and they also had British blood and Norman blood in their veins.
So this was a long-standing family residence, and then... At one point, it came on the market, and for some reason, you bought it. You and your husband bought this.
My husband wanted to do general farming. He was on quite a small farm, 5 or 6 acres, and he was into horticulture.
Okay.
And he wanted to do mixed farming. He came from a farm. His mother had a farm, and he wanted to farm himself, and he needed more land.
Well, he had plenty of land here, but then you also had... The big house.
Yes, for better or worse.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, did you say you divided it in two or what?
We did, yes. It was far too big. At that time, we had only two little girls, very tiny, and it was far, far too big. So we did divide. It's a very easy house to divide because there are two stairs in it, and that's right. One of the points that you want to watch. And we put our farm manager into one part of the house, because my husband wanted to make sure that his other business, that he could give it enough time.
And so what did you grow those early years?
Well, we always had cows, pigs. We had sheep for a bit. We had, for a little while, we had veal calves. We always had eggs for the house, hens and eggs for the house, still do. And in Shamigary then, they grew tomatoes, cucumbers, apples, mushrooms. And
they also grew 11 acres of cauliflowers, you told us earlier.
No, that was here.
You grew 11 acres of cauliflowers.
One year we grew 11 acres of cauliflower here, and it all ripened in the same week.
So you had to go scrambling for recipes.
Yes.
Now, you said that you were not a trained cook, but you trained yourself through reading cookery books.
Yes, I actually did a year in the School of Commerce in Cork that teaches cooking. So three to something oh, like 3 days a week. I did. It was quite elementary, but I did it. And then I went and stayed with a friend who was a very good cook. And when I came home from her, I got married and came back from our honeymoon. And my husband gave me a lesson on how to scramble an egg the first night home.
Well, now, how you were then asked to write a column from the perspective of a farmer's wife for this journal.
Yes, farming paper, the principal farming paper in Ireland.
The farming paper. And you found that easy because you shared the satisfactions but the problems and everything with your readers. So you had many multiple interests there.
Well, yes, because we were all doing the same thing, running a farm in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And some people would have gardens and some people wouldn't have vegetable gardens. But a lot of people would have carrots and various things here.
Well, how did it go from these, what I will say, humble beginnings, because compared to what it is now, it's literally an empire at this point. How did it go from that to where we are now?
Well, it went partly, it to begin with, it was quite successful, which I wasn't sure about. And we got customers out from Cork and from the town of Middleton, which is quite close.
We just skipped a point, though, because at some point then you converted the dining room to a restaurant. So that's
I did that first day.
Oh, okay.
First day I did that.
All right.
Yeah.
And then took let rooms. So people stayed here?
No.
Not
like that. No, to begin with, we had no bedrooms.
Okay.
And we got bedrooms because of the Irish licensing laws. And it was not too expensive to get a license to sell spirits and beers. If you either had, obviously, were selling drinks, pub, or a hotel. And so I went for a hotel because with a lot of children in the house, the last thing I wanted was to run a pub here.
Uh-huh.
So we went for that, and we had so many rooms in the house anyway because it's so big, we were easily able to do it. And then, of course, when you do that, it's a very mixed blessing because you have people that, for instance, we used to have people that came in the autumn for shooting, and they'd want their breakfast at about 4 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, no.
Yes. So it makes it more difficult, and you have more house to yourself. I mean, in the early days, we could, it wasn't so busy and we are still able to use our house for our own use, but we managed.
Well, you must have met some really interesting people.
Yes, one does, but I don't like to bother interesting people too much, you know. It's enough to be polite to them and make sure they're comfortable without trying to use them too much.
Right. But we still haven't answered this question. What caused it to be so successful and to generate another generation and then another generation?
Well, I think because we're different to a hotel, and we have, there's a country house atmosphere here, if you like.
Oh, yes.
And our staff are wonderfully good, I must say. I have to thank them for that. And we take children, we take families. We rarely have people that object to children. And I think it's more like coming to a home than going into a hotel, and I think that's why.
It is, but also the food is very good.
Well, I do the best I can with it.
Well, you grow almost everything on your
Yes,
property.
We use all our own or locally grown food.
Well, I guess we will get filled in also tomorrow. We're going to be interviewing Dorina, who's the second Mrs. Allen.
Yes.
And then there is another
Rachel.
One. Rachel is her daughter.
Third man, Mrs. Allen, yes.
Pardon? It's her
third Mrs. Allen. And I must tell you that Dorina and Rachel were the two best students I ever had.
Oh, you
Girls used to come to me. I think not always girls, but often girls. And they used to want to learn from what we were doing. And they were outstanding, those two.
Well, and certainly it's a name recognized around the world, and has certainly put Irish cooking on the map.
Yes, I think it did, actually.
Well, it's been a delight to meet you, Myrtle. I wasn't sure we'd be able to catch up with you. But,
well, it's lovely
and we're
to
already,
have you.
And we're very comfortable here already, and we just arrived.
Good, great.
Thank you.
Right, not at all.
And that's all we have time for this week. But yeah,
we should mention that we had a wonderful dinner that night, at Ballymaloe House. Everything fresh from their gorgeous gardens.
Yeah, we had a wonderful stay over, and we went to the Ballymaloe Cooking School, run by Myrtle's daughter-in-law, Dorina Allen. She's be coming up on a future program, as will lots more of the exciting places that we went to stay and where we got to dine. So don't forget to come back and join us. Same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.